United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit is now in session.
Oh, there is no sound. We're here today. Oral argument in U.S. versus Erlaza and others. And we've allocated 45 minutes for each side. And have you divided that time up among yourselves?
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Janice Deaton on behalf of Gustavo Salazar. Yes, we have. We have there are five of us that will be arguing. The remainder of us have either submitted on the briefs or we will be covering the arguments for them. So we have agreed upon ourselves, among ourselves, to divide 8 minutes per attorney and then save 5 minutes for rebuttal. Only one of us will be arguing in rebuttal.
All right. And judges Fletcher and Brunetti are participating through video conference.
Yes.
And you can see them.
Yes. I'm not sure. If I'm looking at the video screen, I'm meaning to look at Your Honors. So if I'm not looking at Your Honors, please forgive me.
Well, you can look at them. The scenery may be better there.
With that, Your Honor.
Go ahead.
Thank you. May it please the Court, as I said, Janice Deaton, on behalf of Gustavo Salazar. He was one of the four crew members on the Gran Toro fishing vessel.
Give me his name again.
Gustavo Salazar Palacios.
Okay.
And again, he was one of the four crew members on the Gran Toro. I will be addressing a couple of arguments this afternoon, namely the MDLEA, the constitutionality of the statute, as well as how it was applied in this case, including whether the issue of jurisdiction or the jurisdictional element should have been presented to the jury and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. First of all, I would begin my remarks by reminding the Court that the last two cases that were in front of this Court, one in 2002, one in 2003, United States versus Smith and United States versus Moreno-Murillo, both concerned the MDLEA. However, they were factually quite distinct. In United States versus Smith, that case concerned a customs waters case where this Court found that or ruled that the district court erred in the way that the district court handled the case. The district court divided the issue and made a court ruling on both the factual issue, if you will, of whether the location of the offense was within the customs waters of the United States. And the district court also made the legal finding whether the waters where the vessel was located was, in fact, within the customs waters. This court found that the jurisdictional element had a legal question and a factual question. And under Inouye Winship and Gowden, et cetera, and that line of cases, the district court should have presented the factual question whether the locus of the vessel was actually within the customs waters to the jury. That case, however, did not present a constitutional challenge. In other words, the appellants in Smith did not raise the Fifth and Sixth Amendment challenges to the statute as the appellants in Moreno-Murillo did. In Moreno-Murillo, the appellants pled guilty pursuant to a conditional plea. And in fact, I represented one of the appellants in that case and specifically argued that the MDLEA violates the Fifth and Sixth Amendments to the Constitution because 1903 Section F, the recent amendment to the MDLEA, specifically requires that the judge and not the jury make the jurisdictional finding.
But you never did get an answer to that, did you, counsel?
No, that's correct. In fact, this court found, Judge Brunetti was also on that panel, that because the appellants pled guilty, they waived any further litigation of any elements of the offense. And in Moreno-Murillo, this court specifically refers to the jurisdictional question as an element of the offense. And we lost, yes. We lost the ability to litigate that in front of this court because it was an element of the offense, and this court found that we did waive that issue by pleading guilty. In this case, however, as the court knows, the appellants all went to trial and were convicted. There was a pretrial hearing. In fact, there were two. One was in April and one was in May. The April hearing, concerned the smaller boat, and the issue for the April hearing was whether the smaller boat was in fact stateless or not. In the record, it demonstrates that the defendants in the smaller boat, and again, my client was on the other boat, but the defendants in the smaller boat submitted affidavits that indicated that they claimed both personal nationality, in other words, that they were all Colombian nationals, and they also indicated that the boat was from Colombia. These affidavits.
What does that mean? Reading the declaration, it states a couple of things. First of all, reading Rena's, and it's the same as a declaration from Murillo, it states that the Coast Guard asked for my nationality. I told the Coast Guard that I was a Colombian citizen from the city of, I think it's Bahig, Colombia. I also told them that our boat from Brazilon was from Brazilon, Colombia. But he doesn't indicate he's the captain. It doesn't indicate that he was in charge. And it doesn't say that they asked him what the nationality of the boat was. How are we supposed to interpret that?
Well, I guess my first response to that is that that is a factual question that the court did resolve against Mr. Murillo and Mr. Reyno Aborno. But in fact,
is that factual question within the subject matter of all of our cases with regard to nexus? Is that a question, or for that matter, not nexus, with regard to statelessness, is that factual question part of the jurisdictional issue that the judge decides, or like the customs water case, is it to decide whether or not you're within the customs water of Smith?
Okay. If I can answer the first question that the court asked first, which is, what does this mean? And then I'll get to whether that's a question that the judge should decide, or under Smith, whether that should have gone to the jury. First of all, the burden of proof to show statelessness is on the government. This was the evidence that was presented by the appellants to show that, in fact, they did make an oral claim under the statute of nationality, both of themselves and of the boat. The district court, unfortunately, misunderstood the law, I would submit, and found that because there was no flag, that the small boat was stateless. So this was simply the evidence that was presented by the defendants on the small boat, and I would submit that the court misconstrued the law, that he could consider the oral claim of nationality both for the boat and for the personal nationality of the defendants in its determination.
I'm sorry, the delay is causing a problem. Go ahead.
Secondly, to answer the question, who should make the decision regarding statelessness under Smith, the way that I read Smith is that the court there divided the jurisdictional element into two parts, into questions of fact and questions of law. In Smith, because there was a purely legal question of law, that is, whether on a map the waters that the government alleged the boat to be found in were in fact found in those waters. Whether the area where the government alleged the boat to be found in was an area within the customs waters of the United States is a purely legal question. We don't have a purely legal question here. Both the question of statelessness of the small boat and the question of nexus are both factual questions that are mixed questions of fact and law, and under Gowden must be, and under Smith, must be submitted to the jury. Additionally, the question whether the large boat, the Gran Toro, was under the jurisdiction of the United States in that we know it was a flagged vessel, and the government did, in fact, contrary to what I put in my opening brief, and I apologize for that, they did, in fact, submit the state certification both at the May hearing, pretrial, and at trial, initially, to show that there was concession by the Colombian government to United States jurisdiction. The problem with that certificate is that there was no hearing, and the court told us at the May hearing that the court was to decide jurisdiction and that there, that was simply the end of it, that because the GoFast boat was stateless and our boat, the Gran Toro, was found to be aiders and abettors, the members of the Gran Toro crew were aiders and abettors, that that was the end of the question. After the court made that ruling, one of our co-counsel then asked, well, where's the certification from the State Department? And at that point, the government did provide the certification. There is a dispute whether the certification was obtained lawfully, that is, at the May hearing right after the government presented the certification. It was raised whether that was obtained lawfully, and in my supplemental excerpt of record, I also have provided the court with a log sheet indicating that the Colombian government Navy was attempting to rendezvous with the USS DeWert and the Firebolt and the other ship to try to obtain more information, and that they were specifically directed not to aid Colombia with information. So even with that certification, there's a factual question whether the Gran Toro was in fact subject to United States jurisdiction. But most importantly is that the court...
Excuse me just a second. Can I go back to the factual determination on statelessness? Because the government raised the issue in their brief. You said that there was an attempt being made, I think, by the appellants to show nationality of the boat under the statute. But the government says that is controlled by 1903C3, and there's only three ways that the claim of nationality and register would be included. And the one that seems to fit, if this works or fits, is that the verbal claim of nationality or registry by the master or person in charge of the vessel. And here we don't have that, seem to have that evidence, because neither Rena or Murillo claim to be the master or the person in charge.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Neither
of them were the person in charge.
Make it louder.
Nevertheless, the question isn't, I guess the question for the court today is, did Judge Brunetti?
Well, would that be a legal question?
Judge Brunetti?
Yes.
We're having a problem hearing you. Maybe if there's a mic, maybe you can bring it closer to you.
I'll be right on top, but how's that?
Well, it's slightly better, but it's still not great.
Well, and you're breaking up there. I hear about every third word, so.
Well.
Is there something I can do on this end?
I guess just proceed.
Jim is going to try to raise the volume going into some other room.
Can we maybe stop the clock? Because we're eating up time. It works.
Are you still having trouble hearing me? Because I'm still...
Yeah, they haven't...
microphone.
Judge Brunetti, Jim Barata hasn't come back yet from the control room.
Thank you. Judge Pragerson, are we still waiting for Jim?
Yeah, we're still waiting for Jim.
Can't we go ahead?
Well, we just can't hear. Judge Fletcher, I just barely heard you.
Well, I can hear Mel just fine, and Mel can hear me, and we can hear everything in the courtroom.
Well, I can hear you now. Well, I guess he turned it up.
Okay.
How about me? Are you catching me well?
Oh, you're great now. Okay. All right. We'll start the clock.
Thank you, Your Honors. Ooh, you can hear me, too. Judge Brunetti, I believe that the point that we're trying to make is not so much whether or not the government carried its burden in the small boats case, but the fact of the problem here is that the court removed this question from the jury's determination. In fact, the court told the jury, and this is in the jury instructions at RT 2309, the issue of jurisdiction is not for you to decide. The court has found as a matter of law that the go-fast boat was stateless, and the court has also found as a matter of law that the fishing vessel Gran Toro is subject to the jurisdiction. That is a directed verdict as to one of the elements of the offense, the jurisdictional element.
Now, counsel, would we not have to find subparagraph F unconstitutional if we are to agree with you?
Yes.
Congress has specifically said it's for the judge.
I believe that that's what makes 1903 unconstitutional, Your Honor, is that Section F does remove it from the jury. And, in fact, in United States v. Breaux, the Seventh Circuit case that's relied upon by this en banc court in United States v. Buckland, has a sentence. I believe that this court quotes United States v. Breaux to say, look, 841 sub B does not tell us who must decide the quantity, nor what the standard of proof is for deciding the quantity. In other words, this court can still find that subsection B of 841 can go to the jury, and as an element of the offense must be decided beyond a reasonable doubt, must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. The sentence before that in Breaux says, if 841B told us, or if Congress in enacting 841B specifically told us that the judge, not the jury, must make the determination, we would have a constitutional problem. That's exactly what we have here, and that's why 1903 is unconstitutional. I'm looking
now, counsel, under Smith, the court kind of divided it into legal and factual.
Correct.
And maybe trying to save F so it would not be unconstitutional? Do you think that's what's happening?
I don't know how F could be severed out given Congress's clear intent. They enacted subsection F after this court, the Ninth Circuit, had found the jurisdictional element to be an element of the offense. That must go to the jury. And about a year after that, Congress specifically enacted Section F. So their intent is clear. I don't think it's severable, and I don't think that that the statute can be saved by the constitutional avoidance doctrine either, because there's no other susceptible definition. I would like to
tell the court. Has any other court ruled whether subsection F is unconstitutional?
Is unconstitutional? No. The 11th Circuit in Tinoco did uphold it. However, the 11th Circuit also said that quantity does not need to be pled in an indictment. Tinoco's inapposite for many reasons.
Do you know of any other situations where the jurisdiction of the court is left to the determination of the jury?
Well, in bank robbery cases, for example, the jurisdictional element of being federally insured must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. There are many instances where those jurisdictional elements must be proven. In United States versus Gomez, we have the arson of the rental property, the fact that it that the rental property affects interstate commerce must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. So the jurisdictional element, I believe it's in United States versus Gonzalez, which states that even though it's a jurisdictional element, it's still a material element which must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt. I want to tell the court my time is way beyond the 8 minutes that's been allotted me. I would just very briefly like to indicate that the court does not need to find this statute unconstitutional facially. The way that it was applied in this court, in this case, by the court removing it from the jury, and by directing the verdict as to this element.
Well, let me ask you, what should the court have instructed the jury in this case to do?
The court should have instructed the jury that it must find the element of jurisdiction, that the go-fast boat was stateless, that the grantora boat, that the government ceded jurisdiction, and a nexus, because the grantora was clearly a flagged vessel, and we didn't even get a nexus hearing. It was done away with by the court's reasoning that because the Gran Toro crew were aiders and abettors and the go-fast boat was stateless, the court did respectfully sort of a convoluted Fourth Amendment standing argument that we were not entitled to a nexus hearing. But the court should have required the government to prove statutory jurisdiction, that is, that the boat was either stateless or that the government of Colombia conceded jurisdiction, and then constitutional jurisdiction, i.e. nexus, as to at least the Gran Toro.
What does nexus cover? What does that mean?
Nexus requires that the cocaine that was found on the small boat was destined for the United States. It's the connection between the offense, if you will, and this country, which would grant, under due process, some sort of jurisdiction and fairness to bring these people from off the coast of Colombia to the United States for trial.
Well, is there more to the jurisdictional element than nexus?
There are the two parts. There's the statutory jurisdiction, which is finding that a boat is either stateless under 1903 or finding that the Colombian government conceded jurisdiction if it's a flagged vessel like the Gran Toro was. And then the second part of that is the constitutional element, which is nexus, which is showing that there is a connection between the offense and this country, the United States. Did that answer the court's question? Maybe I didn't understand.
Well, you know, this whole area is very weird. And
especially when we have cases like the United States.
Why doesn't this fall under the definition of piracy, which is a flexible definition?
Right.
Changes with time.
Right. Well, it was argued, not in my brief, but it was argued that piracy covers specific offenses and that this offense doesn't fall under the definitions of piracy. And I must confess to the court, I'm not totally prepared to go into, I would rather submit that on the briefs on the issue of piracy. That's been argued, that's also been ruled on, and in other cases. But I'm not conceding that, I'm just saying that I would rather submit the issue of piracy on the briefs. With that, Your Honors, I will submit.
So what should the government have done here to prove its case?
The government should have presented evidence to the jury regarding statelessness. The government should have presented evidence to the jury regarding the flagged vessel, and we would have presented evidence to show that, to prove that the authorization was either not obtained lawfully, and the smaller boat would have presented evidence that they did in fact make a claim of nationality, and then the government
which was Colombian.
Correct. And then the government would have to prove nexus that the cocaine was destined for this country.
So the government just botched this whole thing.
I believe that the government did not carry its burden of proof.
Okay.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Mark Fleming. I represent David Murillo. I'm with the Federal Defenders of San Diego. And I am here this afternoon to address the issues of prosecutorial misconduct. And I would like to begin with the comments made by government counsel during the rebuttal portion of the government counsel's closing argument. And I will be referring to the excerpt of record filed by Mr. Murillo, specifically Volume 2, pages 352 to 372, in the course of my argument. And I quote, during the government's closing rebuttal, Prosecutor Gallo stated, and this is on page 352 of the excerpt of record, 2231, in a short period of time, the case will be handed to you. You are going to go back into that deliberation room, and that presumption of innocence that these men have all been cloaked with for the last year while we've litigated motions. You've heard about all the motions that have been held beforehand. That's why it's taken so long to get here. That presumption, when you go back into that room right behind you, is going to vanish when you start deliberating. And that's when the presumption of guilt is going to take over. At that moment, there were a blizzard of objections for, I think, what are obvious reasons. The government has since, in its brief, ceded error. This objection, these objections were met with the following response from the district court, and this is found at page 353, upper left. We move for a mistrial. And the district court responded to this objection by making the following statement. That's proper rebuttal. Go ahead. You are all right. Referring to his comments to Mr. Gallo's rebuttal. Our position is this. That comment and the court's imprimatur on that comment amounts to structural error. And we rely upon, first of all, the United States Supreme Court Sullivan, which states that a misinstruction on reasonable doubt is structural error per se. There is no harmless error analysis. By the court's imprimatur on the presumption of innocence vanishing upon the start of deliberations, that is the equivalent of a misinstruction on the burden of proof, on reasonable doubt. They are one and the same. There is a line of cases that this Court recently decided that fall well within that reasoning and that holding in Sullivan, including U.S. v. Powell and U.S. v. Condi. And what the Court in those cases referred to is when there's an error based upon the judge's commenting on a prosecutor's closing argument or instructing the jury during the course of a trial in a way that would undermine the confidence of the jury's verdict because it affects the framework of the trial as a whole.
Counsel, the judge did not make that instruction, though, and didn't the judge give some curative instructions and instructions to the jury after that comment?
The instruction that the judge, first of all, there was a discussion that followed regarding the curative instructions, and the government, in its brief at page 62, states that the defense specifically asked that an instruction not be given. That, in fact, is not true, and the record is clear that the defense attorneys, we asked for a curative instruction at the very first break, and we specifically requested that the court instruct that the presumption of innocence does not vanish upon entering the jury room. And the court, after hearing this argument, decided that it would not instruct at all at that time. There was a curative instruction given 72 pages later into the transcript when the court, prior to instructing the jury on the actual jury instructions, at the close of the government's rebuttal argument, after having a series of breaks, the court, before giving the actual jury instructions, prefaced the jury instructions with the comment that, as you are probably aware, there is no such thing as the presumption of guilt. The presumption of innocence applies. Now, first of all, under the Kerr decision in the circuit, that instruction was too little, too late. It was 72 pages in the transcript after the error, after the imprimatur was given by the court, and it also was too general in nature. It did not refer the jury back to the error and state, in essence, what you heard from the prosecutor was wrong. There is
what you heard from me was wrong.
What you heard from me, more importantly, yes, more what you heard from the district court judge was wrong. My endorsement of this comment that the presumption of innocence vanishes was wrong. The presumption of innocence remains with you, the jury, through deliberations. And that, of course, is an essential bedrock concept. In order for a person to be given a fair trial, the jury cannot misunderstand something as basic and fundamental as the presumption of innocence remaining throughout deliberations. And if you look at the curative instruction, the exact curative instruction that was given by the district court, this is at the excerpt of record, page 370, and specifically at page 2303 of the transcript, there's something very important missing from that so-called curative instruction, and that is that the presumption of innocence does not vanish upon the start of deliberations. That was never corrected, even if, as the government argues, there was a curative given, and even if that curative, despite the delay and the generality, were to cure the part of the comment that related to the presumption of guilt. The court never informed the jury that the presumption of innocence vanishes upon the start of their deliberations. And therein lies the problem. And the government will not be able to point to any place in the record where that correction was made, because it simply wasn't made. The those two concepts are not mutually exclusive. For example, the jury could accept the judge's curative that the presumption of guilt is non-existent, and yet still, based upon what the judge had said earlier, believe that the presumption of innocence has vanished at that point once deliberations start. The cases that address this in the Ninth Circuit are quite clear. The concept as fundamental and as basic as a Sixth Amendment right to due process, which is embedded in the whole concept of the presumption of innocence remaining throughout jury deliberations, is not subject to a harmless error review under Sullivan, Powell, and Condi. The basic reasoning behind that is that a mistaken description of the presumption of innocence affects the jury's ability to apply the reasonable doubt standard correctly. And that is exactly what happened here. It's not subject to an analysis whereby there was a piece of evidence that was improperly introduced, or a comment on some piece of evidence that was inappropriate. This affects the entire way that the jury viewed the evidence in this case, and it would cause an appellate court to simply speculate as to what a properly instructed jury might have done with the evidence that was presented. And that, of course, cannot be corrected, and that is not something that the appellate court is in a position to do. This jury was absolutely tainted by this misinstruction and the imprimatur by the court in response to our objections. The government's arguments that we failed to, well, first of all, that the comments were invited, I think, are just meritless. There was no comments by defense counsel that invited the prosecutor to basically eviscerate the whole concept of the presumption of innocence. And second, their second point at page 62 of their brief involved the fact that the curative instruction was specifically not asked by defense counsel. That is not true, not supported by the record. And third, their position that the curative that was given somehow cured the error, as I just discussed, nowhere near cures the error. And so this is a question of simply our clients receiving a fair trial, and they did not receive a fair trial given the egregious statements of the prosecutor followed by the imprimatur of the court. I see I'm running out of time.
Well, we got your argument pretty well in hand.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is John Lanahan. I'm appearing for Mr. Solis, who is the captain of the large boat, the Grand Toro. There is one part we were trying to do some tag-teaming on this. There was an aspect of the prosecutorial misconduct which I think is more focused on the larger boat rather than the small boat. I was just going to cover that briefly, which is that during the initial argument by the prosecution, there was the claim that there were confidential informants or information from confidential informants that somehow had specifically identified the Grand Toro as a logistical supply vessel. I objected to that because there was no evidence of it. That objection was overruled. The government has indicated in its brief that this was a proper objection. They have left out the fact that my proper objection was overruled. The basis on which the district court had made that ruling was that it was within the expert opinion of the government's what we call profile expert. Mr. McCabe will be handling that sooner, I hope, than later. But that was not a basis for a proper expert opinion. First of all, there was no evidence to support that. Secondly, it would be inadmissible as an expert opinion under Rule 703. So that for that additional reason, there was a misconduct that was implying to the jury that there was somehow other evidence out there that showed that the Grand Toro knew or was involved as had a function as a logistical supply vessel. That leads to what is an issue that is really specific to my client. It affects slightly another crew member whose name is Mr. Perlasa, and that is that prior to trial, I had specifically requested the government produce any 404B evidence concerning the Grand Toro, and the response from the prosecutor was, we have produced everything and none of it is 404B. Based on that, I assumed that the government was going to offer nothing outside the arrest or stop of September 10th and September 11th of 2000 to show knowledge. Lo and behold, however, during the trial, the logbook was admitted. Now, I did not object to the admission of that logbook. Similarly, this court had a similar case like this in a case called Ordonez, in which there were ledger books. There was no objection to the actual admission of the ledger books because they were seized, but it was the contents. Once it was clear that the government was going to get into the contents of the logbooks, I did object. And that was inadmissible for a couple of reasons. First, there was no authentication of whether or not these were done by Mr. Solis. In fact, there is no evidence, but my client is illiterate. But regardless of that, there was nothing to show that this was by Mr. Solis other than these written things that say Jose W. on it. There's no showing of handwriting. There was no showing of fingerprints. There was nothing to authenticate that logbook as an admission by Mr. Solis. And the government has now argued that that is an adoptive admission, but without any proof of authentication, you can't adopt it. There's also an absurd point in their argument, which is it has to be consistent, or actually it was that it's inconsistent with his actual statements at the time, and so therefore they're not adoptive admissions. The other basis on which they did it was, and they're claiming that these are business records. There is nothing to show. I'm not sure there was a business manager for the Grand Toro. You've never seen the Grand Toro, but it was a rust bucket and a half. But assuming there was someone who was going to talk about business records, there was nothing to show that these were admissible as business records. So first, they're inadmissible because they were not authenticated. And secondly, the effect was exactly 404B. The government argued that because these were log admissions made by my client at other times, and he was the captain, he was therefore familiar with the boat, He had been out at other times on this boat, therefore fitting in with their testimony, or the expert testimony, that this was somehow continuously involved as a logistical supply vessel, and also arguing consciousness of guilt. He had said he didn't know what zone he was in when he was stopped, and then these log entries say, lo and behold, we are. So for those reasons specifically, it was prejudicial in as affecting my client, showing his guilty knowledge. So, and just to indicate the evidence otherwise, there was no cocaine on this vessel. The only basis on which it was, this was essentially, this was a circumstantial case. Now, I understand it is a large ocean, but there was no statements. There was nothing from any informants that showed any knowledge on this. There was no cocaine. This is one of the few cases where this Court has seen where we had one of these large vessels, and there was no drugs on it. So the effect on this, the 404B evidence from my client, was prejudicial. And I am trying to do this in less than... I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Let me ask you about your argument that the logbook is not a business record. Every ship has a logbook, has a log, and entries are made into it routinely. So unless there's something into the authentication argument, it seems to me it is a business record.
Well, as I look at it, the rules of evidence require that you actually have to have the custodian of the records bring it in. And there was no custodian that talked about that. The only thing that we had was it's on the ship, and now it's seized. But for a business record to come in, you have to have the person who was actually responsible for maintaining those records. And that person was never called. So I mean, unless the Court wants to create the logbook exception to business records, they're required. You have to have someone come in and say, yes, this is the ship's log. Now, I don't know how they could have done that, but even without the business records issue, there was nothing to show. And if you actually look, and it's in the government's response, in their supplemental excerpts, they have pictures of these logbooks. If you look at it, the handwriting itself doesn't even match. So any kind of basis, just a visual view for authentication, these wouldn't have been sufficient. Thank you.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael McCabe. I represent Appellant Hugo Marquez, who was the engineer on board the Gran Tauro. I'd like to briefly address an issue which affects only Mr. Marquez. That's the Miranda issue, whether Miranda warnings were required to be administered to him prior to his interrogation on two occasions. On the first boarding of the Gran Tauro, which occurred on September 3, 2000, and then on the later boarding, which ripened into the actual apprehension of the vessel and its being escorted back to San Diego on September the 11th. These were non-consensual boardings by the Armed Coast Guard Leadit Team, that's the Law Enforcement Detachment Team, and after which the members of the crew were mustered at the fantail and maintained at that position by armed guards. They were permitted to leave that location to go to the bathroom and or the galley for meals only with an armed escort. They were detained in this fashion for 9 hours on the first occasion. On the second occasion, for something in excess of an entire day, the government says the decision to bring them to San Diego was decided on the 12th. Actually, the testimony was that it was on the 13th. But in any event, we have a massive detention here with the show of force, which the government is trying to equivalent to a traffic stop. This was not a traffic stop. Their fallback position is that these are routine questions which were conducted by the Coast Guard, and then cite some authority both from this court, earlier cases, that is prior to Stansbury versus California, and cases out of the Fifth Circuit, saying that routine questioning or purport to hold that routine questioning by the Coast Guard does not require Miranda warnings. Well, none of the cases really say that. The two cited out of this court, Choice and Baker, both of which were decided prior to Stansbury versus California, were boardings of American flagged vessels in the customs waters of the United States. In each of those cases, the situation was akin to a border search, much more so than here, where the boarding takes place on the high seas of a foreign flag vessel. The Warren decision not only involved, that's the Fifth Circuit case they rely upon, not only involved a U.S. flag vessel, was decided prior to Stansbury, and the Fifth Circuit there in Bonk determined by the application of its four-factor test that Miranda warnings were not required. Well, two of the four factors were the subjective belief of the interrogating officer and the subjective belief of the person being interrogated. Stansbury says in 1994 that the only relevant inquiry is what would a reasonable person in the position of the detainee think, that he was detained in this case under circumstances which are tantamount to those of formal arrest. It could be no other way. The final justification offered by the government is that the questions were not designed to elicit an incriminatory response and therefore did not require Miranda warnings. Well, both Chief Van Pelt, who headed up the Leavitt team on September the 3rd, and Max Seda, who headed up the Leavitt team on September the 11th, specifically stated that they asked the questions because they wanted to know whether Mr. Marquez, the engineer, was going to tell them the truth. They already knew the answers. And so to say that these were not designed to elicit an incriminatory response is to fly in the face of reason. Prejudicial effect was obvious. The government does not even claim otherwise in its brief. I'd like to touch briefly upon profile testimony, which was permitted in this case, impermissible profile testimony. The government claims that this sort of testimony offered by Commander Matthews was authorized by the court's decision in Klimovicius. Well, Klimovicius authorized in limited circumstances where there are complicated factual natures and the nature of the inquiry is something beyond the ken of the average juror, such as maritime smuggling, that the testimony there as to the smuggling routes in the area, how motherships are disguised as fishing vessels and take circuitous routes to their destinations to avoid detection, and explain the compartmentalization of a smuggling operation is would have been all right if that's what had it had been limited to in this case. But here, Commander Matthews was permitted over timely objection to go a lot farther than that, to characterize the Gran Tauro as a profile LSV or logistical supply vessel, and essentially to opine as to the guilt of the crewmen of the Gran Tauro. That clearly is impermissible. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the Court. My name is Casey Donovan, and I represent Fernando Lopez, who is a member of the small boat. And I'm going to spend most of my time with regard to the sentencing issue, but I just want to, for the members of the small boat, reiterate that it is our position that that Smith and the other cases, that it is an element of the crime, that they were on a boat subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. That was taken from the jury, and the directed verdict was given with respect to that, and that they did not do anything except treat the small boat as stateless. They never contacted Columbia whatsoever in any way or form to see if it was registered at all, which is now a different policy, and the newer cases are doing that as a matter of course, but they didn't do it in this case. With respect to the sentence, as your court is aware, Mr. Lopez received a sentence of 200 months. Mr. Aborno received a sentence of 108 months. Mr. Aborno also received -3 for acceptance. He received -2 for safety valve, and Mr. Lopez was denied those findings by the court. It's the Mr. Lopez's belief that the record is incomplete and this case should be remanded back to the court for clarification on those issues. With respect to the safety valve, it's the appellant's position that the law of the case precluded the government from making the arguments against safety valve that they made against Mr. Lopez. In Mr. Aborno's case, the court found that he was entitled to safety valve, and as a legal matter, he had to find that no one died as a result of the incident, which he found, and that he had told everything credibly that he knew about the case. He made those findings despite the government's objection to it, saying that they had debriefed Mr. Adorno, did not find him credible, did not find that he had truthfully said everything he knew about the matter. The court said, I find that he doesn't have to, you don't have to like the answers. He came in and talked to you for an hour, and that's sufficient. With respect to Mr. Lopez, who relied upon that finding. Mr. Lopez was sentenced 2 months later. He relied upon the court's ruling as to Adorno, that, and Mr. Adorno, as I put out in the record during his plea, admitted that Freddie was on board. He was on the boat and therefore died during the crash. So Mr. Lopez was relying upon the court's ruling as the basis for the safety valve. Went in, told the same story. The government heard his version and said, we don't believe you. And then, more importantly, when they appeared for sentencing, said, Mr. Lopez is not entitled to the safety valve because either Freddie was on board and therefore he died and he's not entitled under prong number three, or he's lying about Freddie and therefore he's not entitled to it under prong number five. Both of which had been already ruled upon by the court. So the court, they should not have been able to make those arguments and have it held against Mr. Lopez. Significantly, the court, in finding the only distinction, he said, with respect to Adorno and Lopez, that Mr. Adorno had pled guilty and admitted knowledge, and that Mr. Lopez hadn't. Well, the Ninth Circuit rule is that you don't have to get acceptance of responsibility in order to get safety valve. So he was incorrect in his following of the Ninth Circuit law with respect to that issue. When asked to explain the vast disparity between the sentences, for example, Mr. Borno and Mr. Rayner, who pled on the day of trial, both got the third point for acceptance, all 3 points for acceptance, both got the low end of their sentencing range. Mr. Rayner got 135 months, Mr. Borno got 108 months, Mr. Lopez got 200 months. Above the low end of the range of 188 to 235. The court, in explaining it, says the reason for that can be totally explained by the acceptance of responsibility. And as I pointed out in my brief, he clearly said that the people who pled guilty got the acceptance and the people that went to trial were not entitled to it. This court has recently said in Ocaud-Gatan and Cortez, where the similar situation came up, where the district court had been under the impression that they couldn't give the third point because the defendant had gone to trial and argued and put the government to proof. This court, the Ninth Circuit, in both those cases said it should be remanded back to the district court because the court, seen by the language that it said, that it didn't have, that the person who went to trial automatically cannot get acceptance. And in this, as I said, those are two recent cases, and there's a third case, United States versus Datechild, with a 2004 Ninth Circuit case, which reiterated the situation that the guidelines clearly a person can get acceptance even if he goes to trial. And as we laid out in the brief, in this case, Mr. Lopez made clear to the court the reason we were going to trial was for legal jurisdictional reasons to contest the constitutionality of the statute. He did not testify. He did not put on any evidence. And it's our position that he was entitled to at least the judge looking into and giving reasons for not giving acceptance. So it's our position that from a due process point of view, we have two individuals completely in the same situation, both on the same boat, both arrested and charged. The only difference is that Mr. Borno pled guilty on the day of trial and got safety valve and acceptance of responsibility. Mr. Lopez did not plead guilty and didn't get any of the reductions. So we have two individuals. One's getting 200 months above the low range. The other one's got 108 months. And 92 months, 8.5 year distinction. Capriola says that if the record isn't clear as to the reason for that discrepancy, that the case should be remanded back.
Counsel, did your client ever acknowledge that he knew about the cocaine?
Yes, Your Honor. In the debriefing, he had said that because of the amount of money that he had been paid to go to the boat, as opposed to what he was normally paid as a fisherman, that he had deduced, even though he wasn't directly told, that it was for an illegal purpose and probably drugs. Now, what's important about that is when we went to the debriefing, Mr. Lopez made that statement and was continually willing to continue to be debriefed. The government, once he said that Freddie was on board, said, that's the end of the discussion. We've heard this lie before. And they didn't go, they ended the debriefing. So the point was he wasn't able to expound on that or be asked further questions. Then when we came to sentencing, as I mentioned earlier, the government said he can't get safety valve because Freddie was on board, and if Freddie wasn't on board, he's not telling the truth. So from a factual point of view, the court wasn't able to have a fuller reading of that. But, yes, he did make that admission, and we believed it was important at the time. But the point was that the government cut off the interview and ended it because of the testimony about Freddie. And as I put in my – it is in the record – you know, Avorno clearly said that Freddie was on board and died during the crash. I think my time is just about
passed.
We would ask that it be remanded to the district court. Thank you very much.
All right. Does that take care of all the defendants? All right.
May it please the Court, Patrick O'Toole and William Gallo on behalf of the United States. Your Honor, we're having two attorneys that are going to be arguing the government's side of this particular case. I'm going to address the defense objections to closing argument, the comments that were made at closing argument, and particularly the argument that was made by defense counsel for Mr. Murillo relative to the presumption of guilt argument. Before I start, however, I would like to thank the Court for moving this oral argument date, which allowed us to have Mr. Awase Gallo present here today. Otherwise, he would not have been able to be here. Your Honor, in reference to the presumption of guilt statement that was made during closing argument, I think the government has made it perfectly clear in its brief that we do not believe that the words presumption and guilt should ever be linked. It was a mistake that was made. It was a mistake that was made in the heat of the argument as found by the district court judge, but it should not have been made. Mr. Gallo has never done that before, and neither he nor any AUSA that I know of will ever do that again. But it wasn't deliberate, and that's why the judge on two different occasions made a finding that it was improper, but it was not misconduct, because nobody believes and nobody is going to suggest to the jury that there is any such thing as presumption of guilt. Mr. Gallo, after listening to the last of 10 defense closing arguments, as the judge found, there was it got heated at a certain point in time. The attorney for Mr. Carrasco, Mr. Barrett, had said for a second occasion. I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did you hear me ask a question? Did you hear me?
No, I didn't hear it at all.
Okay, now you hear me.
Yes, I do hear you.
I found in reading this transcript that this was absolutely unbelievable. I can't imagine a U.S. attorney serving our government ever making such a statement in the heat of argument. I just can't understand it. And do you people hold moot courts before you come to arguments on such important cases, or what do you do to have anybody make such a mistake?
Your Honor, in every case that is going to be argued before the Court of Appeals, we have a moot court. We also have trial team meetings before every case that is going to be tried. I can assure you that there was no discussion of the fact that the government was going to be arguing something about presumption of guilt. What happened in the case was...
That was said.
Yes, no, it was
that
said.
That was said, you know, and there was an objection. It was overruled.
If I might back it up, it was mistakenly said. In other words, Mr. Gallo didn't...
What difference does it make whether it was a mistake or not?
Well, it makes a big difference.
The jury heard the words.
It
presumption
makes
of guilt. As soon as they went into the jury room, the presumption of innocence, you know, was dispelled or vanished, and the presumption of guilt obtained.
No, that's not true. Because if you look at what happened in this case, and it was very, very important, what happened was
read me those words again. That's what I heard.
I will. No, you heard the words, but what happened after that? In other words, Mr. Gallo said that. He said, that's when the presumption of guilt is going to take over once you, he was interrupted, an objection. Rightfully so. He should have been interrupted. There should have been an objection. The judge himself misheard it. Now, I refuse to believe that AUSA Gallo, an AUSA of 15 years, who is a military judge himself, Judge Whalen, who's been a judge for probably 20 years, is going to say, oh, yes, that's right, go ahead, counsel, if he heard it correctly. It was such a unique, strange thing that was said that it made no sense. I mean, it was a mistake for it to be said. It wasn't intentional. And what the judge said was, go, because the judge didn't hear it correctly. That's what happened. Go ahead, counsel. That's all right. Now, what happened after that, and this is what is critical. Did Mr. Gallo go ahead with that line of argument? Absolutely not. If you look at the government excerpt at page SER 608, AUSA Gallo left this area completely. He moved to his central theme that the Grand Toro was a logistical support vehicle. Then there was a sidebar in regard to this. Counsel said, rightfully so, they brought up the government shouldn't be talking about presumption of guilt. You shouldn't have that. Now, defense counsel stood up and said that they wanted a curative instruction and the judge wouldn't give it. That's not correct. The curative instruction that they wanted was, if you look at SCR 617, Mr. Singleton wanted a curative instruction starting off with that this was absolute misconduct by the prosecutor. And what the judge refused to do was to have as part of a curative instruction anything relative to misconduct by the prosecutor. But the judge said he would instruct the jury that there was no such thing as a presumption of guilt, that the presumption of innocence remains with a defendant until it is disproved beyond a reasonable doubt, which is the correct statement of law. And defense counsel at page SER 619, Singleton, wouldn't agree to a curative instruction without the misconduct. Court again said it was not misconduct. SCR 623, the court says, if you don't want the instruction, then I'm not going to give it. So it was defense counsel who didn't want it because they didn't have the form of the instruction relative to misconduct. But what did the judge do anyways? He asked the prosecutor, what did you say? The prosecutor said, yes, that's what I said. And then what the judge did on his own, he gave the following curative instruction. And this was, and what's important about this is the prosecutor had never gone back to this area in closing argument at all. In other words, it finished with.
But he didn't give that curative instruction right then and there.
He did before the jury started to deliberate.
No, no, he didn't give it right after that misstatement was made.
I agree, but he gave it before the jury started to deliberate. And that is the critical part, because the jury isn't focusing on what happens at that point in time until they start to deliberate. He also separated it from part of the general closing instructions, and it's within 40 pages later, the judge says specifically, also, I'm sure that you're all aware of this, but let me just tell you this even before we begin. There is no such thing as a presumption of guilt in a criminal case. Well, you can't say it any plainer than that.
This why did Mr. Gallo get up and say, I misspoke, I'm sorry?
He should have.
There's no such thing as a presumption of guilt.
I suggest that he should have. Mr. Gallo was confused. This wasn't a deliberate. Nobody thinks there's such a thing as a presumption of guilt. In other words, things got hot. And things got hot for a reason. Now, that doesn't excuse somebody saying something deliberately. But let's look at the background of this just for 1 second. Mr. Carrasco's attorney, Mr. Barnett, said for the second time that his client, who didn't testify, was happy the cocaine was off the street. Clearly improper comment that was made. You, the jury, are the only thing that's standing between life for my client. Direct reference to punishment. Again, an improper comment that shouldn't have been made. Mr. Gallo objected to that comment. The court sustained the objection. Mr. Crosswood's attorney says, I will remember that. When Mr. Gallo started his closing argument at the end of a bitterly fought, important case, there are 6 objections within the first 2.5 pages of argument, 4 by Mr. Carrasco, who was the same person who said, I will remember that. It finished with Mr. Barnett saying that he would keep track of any objections that were made. Now, this doesn't excuse anything that was done in this case. And this doesn't mean that a prosecutor can launch into a deliberate, intentional misstatement of the law. That's not what happened, though. The prosecutor was upset. The district court judge was there, found that he was upset, found that it was heated, and he misspoke. His mouth ran ahead of his mind, and he linked something, presumption and guilt, which has never been linked before by him or anybody else, shouldn't have been linked, moved away from it, as soon as the objections were made, and before this jury started to deliberate, the jury had a correct curative instruction from the court, and the jury had a correct closing instruction given with the regular closing instructions. I also note that Mr. Gallo, on two separate occasions and one occasion following this argument, reminded the jury that the government had the burden of proof to prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, what's important about all this is for two reasons. One, it separates something that was improper, something that was error, and something that was a mistake from something that was misconduct. He made a mistake in the heat of the moment. It wasn't deliberate. The judge twice found that it was not misconduct. But, again, Your Honor is correct. The jury heard it. So the question is, all right, what did it do? Did it prejudice the case? It would have prejudiced the case if Mr. Gallo had stepped back into it after the judge said that it's okay, go ahead, and said it again. Then it would have been too late to unring the bell. Or it would have prejudiced the case if the judge left the comment with, that's all right, go ahead, and you had the judicial imprimatur. But that's not what happened. Before this jury ever started deliberating, they had the correct curative instruction, and they also had the correct instructions given by the jury. And that's where the Ninth Circuit case law is very important on this. Defense counsel suggests that this is structural error and cites Sullivan versus Louisiana. But there's a fundamental difference between Sullivan versus Louisiana in this case. In Sullivan versus Louisiana, the court itself misinstructed the jury on reasonable doubt and misdescribed the burden of proof. In the Supreme Court held, Justice Scalia wrote the opinion that when the court itself misinstructs the jury, that it is structural error, it doesn't matter if the error is harmless or not. But that's not what happened in this case. This jury ultimately was correctly instructed, both with the judge's closing instructions and also with the judge's curative instruction. So that's different. In this case, it's somewhat similar to Cox. Cox, we have the government argued that defense counsel had to convince a juror of reasonable doubt. The defense said burden shifting. The court gave no cautionary instruction, but gave the correct standard of proof instruction in closing argument. This court held that that error was neutralized by the trial judge. We did that one step more in this particular case, because unlike the Cox case, in this particular case, there was a curative instruction given. Yes, it would have been better if the judge had heard it correctly and he had given the instruction that he gave 30 pages later if he'd given it right away. And yes, it would have been better if the prosecutor hadn't misspoken himself, hadn't made the mistake that he did. But the question in this case is, was this jury prejudiced, were the defendants prejudiced by what happened, and it just clearly wasn't given the state of the evidence. And what is the jury going to think when this jury is specifically instructed by the judge, you just heard something about presumption of guilt. I'm sure you all know this, but I'm telling you again, there's no such thing as a presumption of guilt. Now, what that jury is going to think, if anything, that prosecutor made a mistake or that prosecutor was trying to do something that he shouldn't have done, and they're going to hold that against the government. It's not going to go the other way. There was no jury confusion at the time that this jury went into that room to start deliberating. There was no jury confusion on what was the presumption of innocence, and there was no jury confusion on the government's obligation to prove something beyond a reasonable doubt. Now, that would be the government's position. I'll be happy to answer any further questions, but we apologize for what we did. It was a mistake. It wasn't deliberate, and we are not suggesting just because the government got hot that that's okay to launch into it. If Mr. Gallo had intentionally done this, it would have been misconduct.
Why say the government got hot? Why don't you say Gallo got hot?
Gallo got hot.
I mean, we're all the government.
I agree. Gallo got hot. It happens. Trials, they're dynamic situations. People get under each other's skins. It was unfortunate what happened. It shouldn't have happened. But I will say that AUSA Gallo has lived with this hanging over his head for approximately 2.5 years. It's very serious allegations were made in the district court against him. Very serious allegations were made in these briefs against him. And it's nothing that he takes lightly, and it's nothing that the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego takes lightly. We take this very, very seriously. Again, shouldn't have happened. No excuse for it. But he's human. He made a mistake. But the defendants were not prejudiced by what happened, and the district court judge took care of it with its curative instruction.
Counsel, what about the comment that the expert witness said that there was a confidential informant? Seems to me that was a pretty serious thing to say.
Well, actually, I think what the expert witness said was fine.
Yeah, I'm saying that what the U.S. attorney said was
yes.
not fine.
No, no, no. The U.S. attorney took what the expert witness said one step farther. In other words, the expert witness was testifying, in effect, among other things, that the Grand Taro was a logistical supply vessel, and that part of his expert opinion was based on the fact that they had confidential information that that area of the Pacific is where boats met up, and that they had radar and they had different equipment like that. So there was confidential informant information as to trade routes, if you will, but not specifically as to that vessel, and Your Honor is correct. But what I suggest to Your Honor is nothing flowed from that, because it wasn't like the government counsel said we had confidential information that this defendant knew what was going on. This case boiled down to, like many cases at the border, did the defendants know about the cocaine, because there was no doubt that there was 5,000 pounds of cocaine on the one vessel, and did the defendants know about the reason for all the extra gas, because it was clear the gas was there as really a floating gasoline station, if you will. And there's nothing that the prosecutor said, and this was a different prosecutor, this was not Mr. Gallo at this point, it was AUSA Alvarez, if I remember correctly, but there's nothing that he referred to regarding confidential informant information that went to the heart of the issue, which was, did these defendants know what was going on, and were they involved in what was going on? So, yes, I agree with Your Honor that he did misstate and overstate the extent of the evidence, but it simply didn't go to the $64,000 question, which was knowledge and which was, you know, which was intent.
What was the purpose of his testimony, the expert?
The purpose of the testimony was to testify about modus operandi and maritime smuggling investigations, and also to offer expert testimony about shipping routes, explanations for why you just don't find vessels in that particular area, you know, of the Pacific there for innocent fishing ventures, and to offer an explanation for what that vessel was. Now, Mr. Gallo will be responding to the specific argument on whether that profile evidence should have been admissible, but I agree with Your Honor.
But what was it admitted for?
Expert testimony to explain modus operandi, to explain what the nature...
Was it admitted for nexus?
I'll let AUSA Gallo...
Don't you know? You've been on this a long time.
Well, actually, Your Honor,
I'm trying to figure out what this nexus thing's all about.
I've been on this case for a long time in reference to the...
I need all the help I can on nexus.
I needed more help in reference to the closing arguments, which was plenty of responsibility for me talking about presumption of guilt, but Mr. Gallo would be addressing that specific question, Your Honor.
It's all right.
Do Your Honors have any more questions relative to the closing argument comments? Thank you very much.
May it please the Court, Counsel. As you all know by now, I'm Assistant U.S. Attorney Bill Gallo, the one who's been the subject of the misconduct allegations, and I'm going to be addressing the other issues.
You know, I remember the first time I was involved in a trial right after I got out of law school. I had these two defense attorneys always beating up on me, and we went out to lunch. In those days, lawyers were very friendly, and I. You know, made some mistakes, and I was fretting about it and talking to him about it. So, a really great lawyer by the name of Malcolm Archibald, he said to me, he said, well, he said, Harry, he said, don't let it bother you. He said, I make one big mistake and one little mistake every day. And, he said, if I can keep it to that, he said, I feel good at the end of the day. So, you know, that happens to the best of us right from the start.
I appreciate that that anecdote, Your Honor. And I assure you, I'm friends with all these folks that are sitting behind me, too.
That's a lesson I learned 100 years ago.
Normally, I don't get hot under the collar. I try not to. I've learned a long time ago that that doesn't get me anywhere and gets me into the trouble that I now find myself when I allow myself to get hot under the collar and get angry and caught up in the heat of the moment. I assure you that that comment made during the closing argument.
I think Judge Fletcher has a question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Yeah, let's kind of get right to the nub of this. Is there any evidence anywhere in this record that this cocaine was found for the United States?
No, Your Honor. There's no evidence of that.
So if we find that nexus is required in this case, you're in trouble. Is that right?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe counsel for the defense, Ms. Deaton, misspoke when she says that the only way to prove nexus is to show that the cocaine or the drugs were destined for the United States. The law is quite clear, even in this circuit, that nexus means not necessarily or only that the drugs are coming to the United States and that we can show that, but the drugs themselves or the activities of the defendants will have some effect in the United States. That could be economic effect. That could be political effect. So the fact that we may not be able to show, and oftentimes we can't show specifically that the cocaine or the drugs are coming to the United States, but we can show through expert testimony, which we did in the Klimovicius case in a pretrial hearing, that the huge volume of the drugs would have an effect in the United States by emboldening the drug traffickers because they obtain considerable sums of money with that, and with that sum of money, they can, you know, bribe border agents and so forth. So
was that evidence? Was anything like that in this case?
No, Your Honor, we didn't need to do that. We didn't need to prove a nexus for a couple reasons. And again, even in this circuit has held that in a stateless vessel case, there's absolutely no requirement to prove a nexus. That's the constitutional jurisdiction aspect of Section 1903.
Why was this vessel stateless?
This vessel was stateless because, one...
You're talking about the fast boat.
Yes, Your Honor. This vessel was stateless because it bore no flag of any country. It bore no markings on its hull or anywhere else that indicated that it was registered in any country. And finally...
What did the people say?
Well, the
we're on that that fast boat.
Two of the people, of the five individuals on the fast boat, two individuals said nothing at all. They remained silent when questioned by the Coast Guard after being rescued from the ocean. Two of the individuals said, you know, they didn't know. And one individual said, boat, I have no flag, or where's that effect? There was a lot of controversy about the translation. So, at the time when the Coast Guard was out on the scene in the middle of the ocean, no one gave any definitive statement that the vessel itself was registered in any particular country, let alone Colombia.
So, counsel, it's Judge Brunetti.
Yes, Your Honor.
As I read the transcript, both Rena and Murillo were asked by the interrogating officer, what is your nationality and what is the flag or the registry of the boat? He indicated that both Rena and Marino both shook their heads at both questions. Am I correct in reading the transcript?
Yeah, I believe you are correct, Your Honor. I believe both Reyna and Marino shook their heads in the negative fashion, indicating that they didn't know when asked.
Well, no. If you say, what is the nationality, shaking the head could be interpreted as saying there is no nationality. Is that right?
I believe so, yes.
Well, see, the problem we have here is there's an issue of whether there's a disputed issue of fact with regard to the statelessness. And if you go to Murillo and Rena's declarations, they state that they said that our boat was from Brasiliano, Colombia. And if that means that it has a state, then that contradicts maybe shaking the head. How do we interpret all these various parts of the record? Because the next question is if it's a disputed issue of fact, is it part of a jurisdictional determination that has to be determined beyond a reasonable doubt by the jury?
I think I understand Your Honor's question. First of all, the declarations provided by Reyna and Murillo offer no help to the defense. The one paragraph of that declaration is said that the boat was from Brasiliano, Colombia. means nothing more than that's where the boat may have come from. That does not mean that the boat was registered or of nationality to that country. Boats come from...
Counsel, I want to stop there because here's where I got a confusion. It's true that both declarations say the Coast Guard officers asked my nationality, but if you read the transcript by admission of the Coast Guard officer, he said, I asked them their nationality and the registry or the nationality of the boat. So the government opened the door by saying, I asked each one of these in mass those two questions. So how do we sort out all those details which seem to be in conflict?
Well, I don't think they are in conflict, Your Honor. The statements made by the GoFast crew on the scene did not indicate to any Coast Guard officer that there was a nationality of this vessel at that time, which at that time made it stateless. The declaration that was provided by two of the defendants, Reyna and Murillo, that were provided much later on during the portion of the hearing where we're discussing with the court the issue of statelessness or not, didn't answer the question either. That one sentence in there says that the boat came from Colombia doesn't answer the mail. The issue is, where is the vessel registered, not where it came from. Vessels can be registered from in any particular country and come from any place. They're not the same thing. And that particular...
As I read, I'm sorry, the delay is causing a problem here. As I read the record, the district judge number one did not mention that sentence relative, our boat came from Colombia. And then I want to have you tie into that last part of my question. You raise at page 41 of your brief the fact that under section 1903C, there's only three ways to show nationality or registry, and because neither of these folks, if you rely on sub C, none of these folks stated that they were a master or person in charge. And then I go back again, if the judge didn't address that statement in the declaration, he didn't address a disputed issue of fact at all relative to the boat, how do we determine, is this an issue of law under 1903C?
I believe it is an issue of law for the court to decide, as clearly intended by Congress in the amendment that they passed in 1996, that's subsection F, that says that matters of jurisdiction, one, are not elements, and two, are issues for the court to decide. And you bring up a very important point, Your Honor, and that is the fact that none of the defendants from the small boat, the GoFast boat, indicated that they were the captain or the master of that vessel. No one. And only that person, under the law, may make the claim of nationality. So even if, I'm sorry, it looks like you're about to ask a question.
Yeah, well, are you going to say then, no matter how many facts you throw out, until someone from the fast boat is identified as the captain, only that person's declarations or statements relative to the boat can be considered?
I believe that that's the state of the law, and that's the state of the law in other circuits as well, that those three factors and only those three factors may be considered by the court in determining statelessness. And until you have someone who's ready to step up to the plate and say, I'm the captain, I'm going to take responsibility for this crew and this vessel that we're on and make that claim of nationality, only until that point in time can that representation be accepted by the Coast Guard and or by the court later on at a hearing to determine statelessness. And that did not occur here. It still hasn't occurred here. And in fact, this gets into a sentencing issue, and that's with respect to this sixth person named Freddie, who a couple of the defendants claimed was in fact charge of the boat, but he died during the collision or perhaps afterwards.
Yeah, but what about, weren't there any records on this boat? Any papers?
Your Honor, if there were records on the boat, ship's documents that could indicate nationality, they went down with the vessel. They went down with the ship.
Well, the ship went down right away, did it?
No, sir, it did not. The vessel stayed afloat for a period of time, I would say several hours. It was bobbing in the ocean like a cork bottle, creating a hazard to navigation. And it was too dangerous. The Navy determined it was too dangerous to go out there and try to inspect. It was like an iceberg. A very small percentage of it was above the surface. Most of the vessel, 25 or 30 feet or so, was below the surface of the water, being flotation being maintained by some air pocket in the boat. Too dangerous to go into to try to find any documents or other incriminating evidence the government may have been able to use.
They couldn't hook up a davit and pick it up.
No, Your Honor, that was hotly contested. That For one, there was no hoisting point on the go-fast boat. Two, it weighed who knows how much. Filled with water, it weighed a considerable amount. The davits on board the Navy vessel, the DeWert, were only rate tested out for 6,000 pounds. That's enough for the small rigid hull inflatable vessels that it has. If you hoisted it out of the water, what does the Navy do? Even if they could, what do they do with their own vessels? So there was no discussion even of trying to get it out of the water. It was a physical impossibility for the Navy to do so at that time. So, but nevertheless, while the go-fast boat, after it had collided.
It was a physical impossibility for the Coast Guard.
I'm sorry?
Was it the Coast Guard or the Navy?
The Coast Guard was on board a Navy vessel.
Right, that's right.
And there were no Coast Guard vessels out there on the scene at the time.
All right.
Moreover, while after the collision between the go-fast boat and the Grand Toro, as I indicated, the go-fast boat remained afloat for a considerable period of time before it actually went under. And during that period of time, all five defendants on the go-fast boat were physically in the boat and had plenty of time to extract any documents if they thought that they were going to be necessary to prove the nationality of the vessel. They did that. They did not do that, excuse me. They did not produce any documents. In fact, they took what little time they had, the hour or so, to completely undress themselves in some instances, or at least get down to their skivvies and jump into the water, further removing any potential incriminating or damaging evidence that may be on their person. The issue of constitutionality, if I may get to that point, I think is a very easy one for this Court to decide. It's been decided to be constitutional by courts elsewhere in the United States as well as here in this circuit. One argument made by Mr. Murillo is that these other cases only decided constitutionality on basis on the Interstate Commerce Clause.
Your argument is that because this vessel was unflagged, that satisfies the jurisdictional issue.
Your Honor, I submit that because the vessel was unflagged, because it contained no markings, and because there were no ship's documents or any other indicia of nationality, the go-fast boat was a stateless vessel. And that was conclusively proven, in my view, or certainly beyond a reasonable doubt, and certainly beyond the preponderance of the evidence, which I believe is a standard at the motion hearing.
That obviated the need for nexus.
There's no need to prove a nexus if the vessel is stateless. There's only a need to prove a nexus or this connection with the United States if we have a registered vessel, like the Grand Toro, which was registered, and that was shown to be registered through documents provided by the Colombian government. But with respect to stateless vessels, the nexus requirement is not required, and that's been proven in this circuit by a couple cases, Caicedo and Judah, most notably that if a vessel and its crew sought the protection of no country by seeking to register itself, then it gets the protection of no country. It's considered to be an international pariah, subject to prosecution by any civilized nation anywhere in the world, for that matter, regardless of where it may be seized.
Now, we don't have any case, do we, which takes the leap that you would like us to take. Assume for the moment that the go-fast is stateless. You say then the aiding and abetting of the Toro can be attached to that statelessness, so you don't need any nexus. Now, that's your argument. Is that right?
That's correct. If I may expand upon it, our argument is that the principals in this particular conspiracy were the defendants on board the go-fast vessel, which was stateless. We believe we proved statelessness sufficiently to the court preliminarily as a matter of law, consistent with the statute as written and intended by Congress. And once we were able to do that, we did not have to prove a nexus since it was a stateless vessel. We believe that the evidence was convincing to the court to show that the Grand Toro and the defendants thereon were aiding and abetting the stateless go-fast vessel by refueling it and allowing it to continue on its journey up the coast to offload the drugs at some further location north of where they were seized. And by being aiders and abettors, encouragers, assisters, if you will, seeking to make the successful or the conspiracy successful, they subjected themselves to the same risk that the GoFast crew subjected themselves, and that is being prosecuted by any country.
Do you have any case that says that? These folks were on a registered vessel.
Yes, ma'am, they were. There's no case.
Case that supports your theory?
The only case, and we cited it, is a 1941 case out of the Sixth Circuit, which simply stands for the proposition that if there's jurisdiction over the principles of a crime, then there are jurisdiction over the aiders and abettors. This is a case in first impression, not only in this circuit, but I believe anywhere else in the United States. And so we can only argue by analogy. I would argue, however, that we conclusively proved that the government of Colombia consented to the jurisdiction of the United States for prosecution of the defendants aboard the GoFast vessel, and in accordance with the statute, as written, as intended, and as decided by every other circuit, the First, the Third, the Fifth, and the Eleventh, who have considered this issue.
I'm sorry, I know what you're going to say because I read right in your brief where you disagree with our authority.
I do.
In this circuit, which says that we have to have nexus. So this panel is kind of stuck with that, so that's why we have to deal with the nexus issue. Can I go on from where Judge Fletcher was? If in fact, you're going to go this route of aiding and abetting, are you saying that the stateless defendants, the stateless GoFast boat defendants, committed a crime under a federal statute, this conspiracy to distribute at sea, right?
That's correct, under Section 1903 of the Maritime Drug Law Enforcement Act.
So that's a federal statute, and the only question we're dealing with is jurisdiction. Now, if that federal statute was accomplished on land, i.e. distributing cocaine, is there any law that says there's no jurisdiction of an aider and abettor to people who conspire on land to distribute cocaine?
If I understand the question...
The defendants on the Gran Toro were at sea, and they were on a flagship, and the question is jurisdiction. Now, if you move it to shore, where there is jurisdiction, is there any law that excludes aiders and abettors from being prosecuted in a co-conspirator when they're helping distribute cocaine?
No, I think that the case would be far stronger for us that we could go after the aiders and abettors no matter where they are, because jurisdiction would be direct if it occurred here in the United States. And so we could go after them no matter where they were. We'd have to extradite them, though.
Are you saying then the concept of aiding and abetting accompanies any domestic crime then?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I didn't...
Well, aiding and abetting could be part of any domestic crime, depending on the facts.
I believe that's true, yes, sir.
Okay. Are you saying then, because this happened at sea, we don't have to look at the jurisdiction then becomes non-existent because it's merely a crime and aiders and abettors regardless of where they were?
No, I still think we need to establish that there is a jurisdiction, and that is whether either vessel is subject to the jurisdiction of the United States, which is required by the statute.
Okay, I understand you now. So what you're saying is even though you disagree with our nexus statutes with regard to flagged ships, you're saying the aiding and abetting is an exception to those cases then. You'd have to say that.
I say that with respect to the specific facts of this case where we have a stateless and a flagged vessel operating together in concert to commit a crime against the Maritime Drug Law Enforcement Act.
And with unconditional consent of Colombia for the U.S. to take jurisdiction?
It wasn't conditional.
Unconditional.
I misunderstood you. Yeah, it was unconditional. We have a bilateral agreement with Colombia that allows us, without first seeking their permission, to board them and search them. Once we find something, then we need to get their permission to go further, and that is to arrest and then prosecute. That's what occurred here, and that was conclusively proven by the Department of State certification.
The counsel for the defendant and the briefs heavily discuss what happened at the district court relative to that certification certificate. Can you give me your position on that?
Sure. I disagree wholeheartedly that there was any shenanigans or deceit on the part of the United States government to obtain the Department of State certification. And there's absolutely no evidence in the record to suggest otherwise. That Not only that, the law, the Maritime Drug Law Enforcement Act, under Section 1903C3, says the Department of State certification, excuse me, C1, Department of State certification, once provided, is conclusive proof that the foreign government, in this case Colombia, has conceded jurisdiction to the United States. It's not a rebuttable presumption that allows the defense to go behind the documents or behind the scenes in an attempt to undermine the certification. The certification is conclusive. End of story. And that certification was provided. It was provided to the district court during the motion hearing to establish the jurisdiction of the Gran Toro under the United States. And I submit that that's all that we need to do. We do not need to go further and show the nexus. And again, I understand this court may be bound by precedent that says we have to prove a nexus in a flag vessel case. That did not occur here.
What do you mean that did not occur here?
We did not put on any evidence whatsoever, Your Honor, during the motion hearing phase, which is where it would properly be provided, to show that the activities of the defendants out in the middle of the ocean, specifically the Gran Toro defendants, since they were on the flag vessel, had any connection with the United States whatsoever. We didn't do that. We've done that in other cases, specifically the Klimavicius case, because at that time we needed to do that, and at least we still need to do that. But we didn't do it here, and we didn't do it here because we submitted, we provided to the court our analysis that since the GoFast boat was stateless.
So the whole thing really hinges on the lack of the GoFast boat flying a flag.
Not only that, it wasn't flying a flag. I mean, that's what the defense says. It didn't have a flag. It clearly didn't have a flag.
Yeah.
But it also had no markings indicating that it was home-ported or registered in any particular country. And that was conclusively proven by the testimony of the witnesses on the scene who actually observed the GoFast during the chase and before the collision and before it sank. Before it sank, it was on the surface and visible. Most of its hull was visible to the folks on the Duwert, the Navy and Coast Guard individuals on the Duwert, as well as the Coast Guard individuals that went out to try to rescue these people, that it had no markings. It also had no documentation indicating nationality. And it had not even these declarations.
How do you know it had no documents indicating nationality?
They were not proven. They were not provided.
Well, we don't know that. We know that it was not taken off the boat, if there was any.
Well, that's true. But there were no documents provided. I mean, you can only go by what we have. We didn't have anything that was provided by anybody on board the boat saying, here are the ship's registry documents, like the Gran Toro had.
Well, who has the burden of proof?
The government has the burden of proof. We met that burden with the evidence that we had. No flag, no markings, no claim of nationality by anyone who could give such a claim responsibly, i.e. the master or captain of the GoFast. No one. It simply wasn't there. And the declarations don't add anything to that equation. So.
Well, what about the piracy provision? I'm interested in that.
Well, this court just last year in the Moreno-Murillo decision said that the constitutionality of this statute can be defended under the piracies and felony clause of the U.S. Constitution under Article 1, Section 8, Clause 10. That there doesn't have to be a showing of an interstate or foreign commerce connection. That clause alone provides Congress with the authority to enact a statute, and therefore it's constitutional.
What was the piracy here?
Again, in that particular case, which Judge Brunetti was on, Judge Brunetti could probably answer this question better than I, said that drug trafficking is a felony under the statute, contemplated by the framers. And so, therefore, drug trafficking being what it is, it is now constitutional for the Congress to enact a statute using the piracies and felonies clause as its basis for constitutional authority to pass the statute. The record below, at least the motion papers below.
If the United States naval vessel concludes, has a reasonable cause to believe, strong evidence to believe that that a vessel is transporting drugs, that that vessel would be a piracy vessel. And then could the Navy just fire away, shoot it, and sink it?
It depends, is the answer. It depends on where the vessel is registered, if it is registered at all. And how that is determined is under international agreement. War vessels from all countries have the right to make contact with vessels that it comes across on the high seas, international waters, using their radio. And they ask what are called rights of approach questions. Who are you? What are you doing out here? What's the nationality of the vessel? What's your nationality? What's your purpose in being out here? What was your last port of call? What's your next port of call? When did you leave? When do you plan on getting there? What cargo you have? Those sorts of questions. And determining on the answers to those questions by the, quote, captain or master of the vessel will determine what the next step is. If, during the answers to those questions, and it wouldn't necessarily be the Navy asking these questions if they were on a drug patrol, which they were in this case. It would be a Coast Guard law enforcement detachment, which by law has to enforce U.S. law, not the Navy. But depending on the answers to those questions, if the answers given indicate that the vessel is registered to a particular country, then there's one of two things that could happen. The Coast Guard could say, may we have your permission as the captain of the vessel to come aboard, even though you may be registered in another country. If the captain says no, then there will be no boarding. What happens in that case is the Coast Guard will then, through using radio, go up to their Coast Guard headquarters here on the West Coast, if it happens in the Eastern Pacific, to the District 11 headquarters at Alameda, say, we have a vessel out here. It's the Grand Toro, for example. It's registered to Colombia. We need verification of that. That communication goes up to Alameda. From Alameda, it goes to Washington, D.C., where there's a Presidential Directive 27 committee, if you will, comprised of State Department individuals, Coast Guard individuals, Department of Justice individuals, and Department of Defense individuals. They get together and they tell, what do you have? Tell us what you have on the scene. Okay? We'll make the determination in Washington whether we're going to contact our embassy in Bogota to pass this information along to the Colombian government in Bogota for permission to board the vessel or to verify that the vessel is in fact Colombian. They do that. The Colombian government responds back, says, yes, the Grand Toro is in fact the Colombian registered vessel. You may now invoke the bilateral agreement that already was in place with Colombia, which allows the Coast Guard then to board, contrary to the consent of the captain of the Grand Toro, whether he wants it or not, and then we can board. The Colombian government could also say, no, we will not allow you to board at that point. So, depending on whether it's stateless or not, if the captain indicates in his answers that it's a stateless vessel, then the Coast Guard can board that vessel, whether the captain consents to the boarding or not. I see that I am well over time, but I haven't gotten to any of the other issues addressed by the defense, and I'm more than happy to continue on if the court would allow me to address some of those issues or answer any specific questions.
What do you want to address?
Well, there's the issue with respect to the statements. There's the issue with respect to the logbook, the expert testimony. I'd like to address it all if I have the time. But I will certainly seek to...
Why don't you just give us a quick... Yeah.
With respect to the statements made by Mr. Marquez, none of those statements were made while he was in custody. They were all voluntarily made. They were all routine questions being asked about gas and where you were located. All those are routine questions under the Colombian bilateral agreement that the Coast Guard needs to ask. Moreover, they were all asked within a very short period of time of the boarding. The defense wants to focus on the lengths of the boarding, which is considerable, no doubt. But the statements were made in the initial phases of the boarding, and therefore Mr. Marquez was not in custody when the statements were made, and they were routine boarding questions, and that's what the court found. With respect to the expert witness, Commander Matthews,
He testified consistent with the this Court's reasoning in Clima Vicius. He testified at no time did he ever say that any defendant, whether it be on the Gran Toro or on the GoFast boat, that any defendant had knowledge. Never said that. Those are never his words. And at no time did he ever say that the Gran Toro and the GoFast were profile LSVs or logistical supply vessels or GoFast. He never said those words. Never. And for the defense to claim that he did is wrong, because the record
says. You really didn't need him.
Well, we did need him, Your Honor. We needed him because this was a complex case. The Gran Toro defendants are absolutely correct. There was no cocaine found on the Gran Toro, but there was a heck of a lot of gasoline, 6,000 gallons worth of gasoline. The vessel was a diesel-powered vessel. Couldn't use the gasoline on board there to operate its main engine. Without some expert testimony explaining what this vessel was doing out there, the jury would be left with one conclusion only, and that would be, well, it's a fishing vessel out in the middle of the ocean, fishing. We needed an expert to explain.
Well, I mean, it was diesel. It was operated by a diesel engine.
That's correct.
And it had all this gasoline.
That's correct.
So it was a floating gasoline station.
No doubt about it.
I thought you were bringing that expert in here to sort of establish nexus.
No, Your Honor. At the trial level, we didn't touch nexus.
Well,
we didn't think it was necessary.
Yeah. Well.
But the expert was necessary to help the jury understand this complicated situation.
It wasn't that complicated. I understand it.
Oh, it was extremely complicated.
Well, it's okay.
I mean, this was, they're out there in the middle of the ocean, and it may seem, you know, almost, you know, what are the odds that a GoFast boat are going to run into the back of another vessel out? And I mean, it wasn't a crowded ocean. But for the jury to understand.
Yeah, but what about what the issues that defense counsel say should have gone to the jury? You know, the jurisdictional issues.
None of those issues should have gone.
The questions of fact.
None of those questions should have gone to the jury.
How about the question of whether this was a stateless ship or not?
That clearly is a question for the court and the court only to decide. I think what's different about these maritime cases are this. Only the United States, as a federal entity, can prosecute these cases that occur out in the high seas. No state can prosecute these cases. They simply do not have jurisdiction. This is not like the Gomez case cited by Ms. Deaton, where you have an arson of an apartment building, which is traditionally, a common law, a state crime. And in order to make it a federal crime, there has to be.
What if there are disputed facts on whether it's a stateless ship or not?
That's for the court to decide as a preliminary matter of law. Courts do that all the time. They do it with, you know, suppression of statements, suppression of evidence, which clearly have maybe as much import, if not more, than whether there's jurisdiction.
All right. What's the next issue you want to talk about?
Well, let me see here. I had a whole list. Safety valve for Mr. Lopez.
You can forget about it.
All right. Then I think I'm done. I think I'm done, Your Honor. Unless there's other questions,
We'll have to get a safety valve for you when you get hot.
Well, I may need a safety valve when this is all over.
Yeah. Appreciate okay.
You. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right, rebuttal.
Excuse me one moment. With the Court's permission, I'd like to take about 2 minutes to discuss the nexus jurisdictional element. Mr. Fleming would like to respond very briefly to the government misconduct argument, and Lori Schoenberg would like to respond to Judge Preggis's questions regarding the Piracy Act very briefly. So if that's all right, I'll just answer very briefly that the question regarding what was shown and what wasn't, first of all, it mustn't be lost that the jurisdictional element is an element of the offense. That's clear in this circuit. That's clear from Smith and from Moreno-Murillo. And it's also clear based on Apprendi and all of the cases that have.
Well, counsel, tell me what disputed facts relate to the statelessness of the Go Fast book boat?
Whether or not the – first of all, we had an interrogator that did not speak Spanish. He spoke, quote, a quarter to a half toward fluency in Spanish. And so that's the first problem. And under, I believe, the case is United States versus Garibay, that alone created a substantial constitutional problem.
But tell us what the disputed facts are.
Whether or not there was a claim of nationality of the boat itself. And nobody asked – again, it's the government's burden – nobody asked who is the captain of this boat. That question wasn't asked and it wasn't answered. We concede that that question was never answered. But it's the government's burden to prove statelessness. They blew up this boat. Just like in United States versus Rendon, it's I would venture to say it's a policy of the government to blow up these small boats. This one had been floating for some time, and they blew it up. So regarding
what the disputed facts, what does have to be decided if we send this back?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that that if it's sent back, it's got to be sent back for a mandate of acquittal, because the jury was never allowed to decide the element of jurisdiction. Regarding statelessness of the small go-fast, the disputed fact is, was there a claim of nationality for the boat and for the individuals? And regarding the Gran Toro, it's undisputed that it's a flagged vessel. The judge at the May 17th hearing told us there is not going to be any issue regarding jurisdiction further discussed. So when we came across the log sheets during trial indicating, quote, contact DeWert, there's a Colombian corvette tasked to turn to meet with the DeWert, and the DeWert was directed to avoid contact and not to rendezvous and not to provide any information to the Colombian Navy. Clearly, that puts in dispute whether the Gran Toro defendants, and I'm referring to the registered vessel of the Gran Toro where there was no cocaine found, there's clearly something going on that had we been able to develop this at a hearing, we might have been able to show to the jury that, in fact, there was no jurisdiction conceded by the Colombian government. That's another question of fact.
Well, the question that you were asked was about the unflagged vessel. What are the disputed issues? Just concentrate on that.
All right. The disputed issue of fact with regard to the small boat is, one, was there a miscommunication between the interrogator, who did not speak Spanish? Two, was there a claim of nationality as to the boat? We have the declarations that are undisputed. The Officer Cruz never said, no, they did not say that the boat was from Colombia. They did not say that. That was never disputed. So we have a declaration on one hand that is undisputed where the defendant said, our boat is from Colombia, and the allegation by the government, not supported by any evidence, that they did not say that. There was testimony that they said the boat does not have a flag in very poor Spanish. But that's the disputed fact. If it does go back, the other thing is, Your Honors, the government knew what the law was regarding nexus, and they just chose to disregard it, just like Mr. Gallo chose to disregard the law when he argued in his closing argument. He knew that nexus is to be proven in this district with regard to state to vessels that are flagged, and they just made a decision to disregard that. Your Honor, Judge Pregerson asked about maritime vessels. In Caicedo, this court has said, and in Caicedo, in Clemavicius, in Judah, and in every case since then, including as recently as in Moreno Murillo, that if a vessel is flagged, then those crew members have the right to believe that because they are subjecting themselves to the law of one nation, other nations will not assert jurisdiction. In Caicedo, this court said that is like prosecuting a crime that happened in Colombia, a bank robbery that happened in Colombia. To prosecute people on a flagged vessel of another nation is just as though we are prosecuting people for committing a crime in that nation.
Well, which ship are you talking about now?
The Gran Toro, Your Honor. So I've answered the question about the disputed fact regarding the go-fast and the fact that nexus was not proved. And because that was not proved, there must be a judgment of acquittal entered for all defendants, because that is an element of the offense. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors. Very briefly, before I address the prosecutorial misconduct, I would like to make one final point as a member of the small boat. The government's logic apparently is that the small boat were aiders and abettors of the large boat, and therefore the large boat sort of bootstraps jurisdiction based on the statelessness of the small boat. Well, it seems like that logic would run in both directions. And so if it's undisputed that the Gran Toro was a flag vessel, and if the theory is that they are aiders and abettors of each other, well, then it's just as logical to infer that those on the small boat were members of the flag vessel, since they're aiders and abettors of each other. Now, addressing the prosecutorial misconduct argument, first of all, in response to our argument, there was a statement that Mr. Gallo's conduct was made in the heat of passion, that he somehow got, I think, lost control of himself. I suggest that the record belies that argument quite clearly. And again, if you look to the excerpt of record at page 352, this begins a little bit before the actual.
I didn't hear anything about a heat of passion, you know.
I think what he said was that he got worked up because of some comments or having to listen to all of us go on during our closing arguments.
Yeah, well, we're all getting worked up now. Go ahead. Move along.
Mr. Gallo had an opportunity to clarify after we were on a break what it was he meant when he said the presumption of guilt applies, and this is on page 358 of our excerpt of record. And in response to the court's question to Mr. Gallo, what did you mean by that when you said, were you talking about when they get back to the jury room and take a close look at the evidence? Is that what you mean? And Mr. Gallo, do you want to respond? And Mr. Gallo responds. Now, this is after the jury had been out on a break. He said, that is what I said. When they get back there and start looking at it, is when the presumption takes over, the presumption of guilt. So he again reinforced the same exact position that he gave in front of the jury. At no time, Mr. Gallo went on for another 70-some-odd pages in the transcript of his rebuttal closing. Never once did he say to the jury, ladies and gentlemen, let me just clarify what I said earlier. I hope you didn't take me to mean that the presumption of innocence vanishes. Never once was that addressed, and he was free to go on with his argument in any vein that he chose. This was a deliberate and calculated argument made by Mr. Gallo, and as you've heard, an experienced prosecutor with 15 years behind him. This is inexcusable. Regardless of whether Mr. Gallo's intent was malicious or willful, the end result is that our clients are paying the price, because we don't know whether the jury.
Yeah, well, we understand that argument.
And the vanishment of the presumption of innocence was never clarified by the court. Thank you. I think we have one final rebuttal argument from Laurie Schoenberg regarding the questions on piracy. Thank you very much.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court. Laurie Schoenberg from the Federal Defenders of San Diego, arguing on behalf of all co-defendants with respect to the Piracies and Felonies Clause. And with this Court's permission, I'd like to also submit an additional sentencing argument that was originally inadvertently omitted from the arguments that were originally presented. With respect to the Piracies and Felonies Clause, the Supreme Court has stated, actually, in Smith and Palmer, that piracy was intended to be a robbery or a depredation on the high seas. That was what it meant at common law. The first Congress acceded to that definition by further defining piracy as something that would only be rendered capital by the laws of the United States if it were committed on the body of this country, and went on to further define a piracy as a robbery or a murder, something akin to that. And as Your Honor knows, drug trafficking is not akin to a robbery or a murder in the sense that there was a direct taking of a person's life. Similarly, the first Congress also defined felonies as serious crimes which justify the total forfeiture of life or property. And the Court in footnote 11 of Tennessee versus Garner states that expressly ties such felonies as serious crimes which are intrinsically connected to capital punishment. As this Court notes, Section 1903, a violation thereof, is not a capital crime. Indeed, as Mr. Murillo and Mr. Carrasco have argued in their briefs, a violation of Section 1903 actually should only carry a statutory maximum sentence of 15 years imprisonment, since drug trafficking under 1903 and under the MDLEA does not fit into piracies or felonies as defined by the first Congress and as not contradicted thereafter, the whole statute is unconstitutional. Now, I know that Mr. Gallo brought up Moreno-Murillo and said that Moreno-Murillo specifically rejected this idea. With all due respect to the Court in Moreno-Murillo, I would ask this Court to disregard that opinion, because Moreno-Murillo specifically relied on two cases, Davis and Aikens, of this Court, to state that the MDLEA is justifiable under the Piracies and Felonies Clause. However, Davis and Aikens never analyzed the scope of the Piracies and Felonies Clause. They never even said the language of the Piracies and Felonies Clause. Those cases each, in less than a paragraph, say, reject Commerce Clause challenges to the statute by saying that the exercise of power under the MDLEA is proper under the Piracies and Felonies Clause. And this Court's opinions in U.S. v. Johnson, a 2001 opinion, and also in U.S. v. Holocaust say that in the absence of reasoned analysis, this Court can actually reject those findings. So I would ask this Court to reject those findings and to hold 1903 unconstitutional under the Piracies and Felonies Clause. Now, with respect to the sentencing argument raised by Mr. Murillo and Mr. Carrasco in their brief, I would point out that the MDLEA provides in Section 1903(g)(1) that any person...
You know, this is rebuttal, see. We never got into that.
I understand, Your Honor. Yeah. Unfortunately, it was inadvertently...
Well, we're well aware of everything that's going on.
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. This matter will stand submitted. Court will adjourn.
Judge Pragerson?
Yes?
Do you want my secretary to place the conference call in 5 minutes?
Sure.
At what number do we call you? Your office there in Pasadena?
Or we can do it right in the conference room.
In the roving room also,
The roving room.
Okay, give me a phone number for that, would you?
7170.
Say it again.
What's my other phone number on my desk? I don't remember.
7170.
I don't know
either. What's that, the extension?
Yeah, I'll tell her.
The last four digits are 7170.
Call.
I don't want any of you to write that down.
Judge Fletcher.
All right.
Judge Fletcher.
Yes?
Fletcher, my office is going to call you and give you a number where to call me.
Okay. Okay. And what's... Give us...
Judge Fletcher?
Yes.
7172 for the roving room.
Thank you. And we'll call
and
in five...
We'll call,
you call five, me and then five. We'll call in 5 minutes. Okay?
5 minutes, okay.
Gotcha.
I'm going to go to the prosecutor so we can talk about that.
I haven't voted yet.
You fly to certain health figures. I always fly to certain health figures.